Here's my topic and the same cast of characters. We really collaborated on all these papers together. I have no financial disclosures and I have no cute photos. And that's really unfair, Chris. That's just so cute. So I will make a different disclosure, which is that I think Bruce Link is adorable. Oh. And it's okay for me to say that because he's my husband. That is something, you know. So I didn't feel myself getting red. I don't know if I'm going to talk about the problem of social desirability in research. When you're doing research that involves asking people questions about things like stigma, prejudice, racism, you have to worry about the problem that people are going to bias their responses in a way that, you know, makes them sound a little better than maybe what they really think towards a more socially acceptable answer. And here's an example. This is a question that I think Bruce put up earlier. Would it be okay with you to invite someone with a mental illness to your home? And I'm answering this question. Or let's say, not me. I wouldn't be biased. But let's say a person is answering this question. And what might they be thinking? Well, you know, honestly, having someone with a mental illness come over once to my home is fine. But then they know where I live. What if they come over again? What if they bug me? What if they want to be friends and I don't? I heard people like that could be dangerous, you know. Honestly, probably no is what I would say, but that sounds bad, and that sounds very unenlightened. So maybe I'm going to edge it up to probably net. Yes, I'm not going to go from the bottom to the top, but maybe I'll just edge it up a little bit. And how can we deal with that kind of social desirability bias in research? Well, one thing is we can measure actual behaviors rather than asking people questions. So if you measure where people are seating themselves, how close to someone with a stigmatized status. So let's say someone has a prosthetic limb or someone's wearing hijab, and you measure how close or how far people sit from them. That's a behavioral measure that isn't subject to social desirability bias. And then we can also measure implicit attitudes, with the implicit association test being a good example of that. To attempt to measure automatic, kind of possibly unconscious reactions to different groups. And for example, do people's reaction times on a task suggest that they implicitly and perhaps unconsciously associate white with good and black with bad? The answer is people do. And we can use these kinds of measures also to circumvent the problem of social desirability bias. And those kinds of measures are great, but they can be expensive if you think of, you know, undertaking a study where you're observing people's behavior in a room. And also, they're more limited in what they can offer. Compared to a survey, where you can see in all the things that we were able to measure, give you access to asking questions about a vast array of things you might be interested in. So we want to be able to deal with social desirability bias within a survey methodology as well. And so some things that you can do are internet or other self-reported, not interview situation, reduces social desirability bias, and we do that. And then, obviously, if you go out of your way to assure participants that their answers are confidential, that's an important thing to do. And then another thing you can do within a survey study is measure social desirability bias and then control it in your analyses. And that's what I'm going to be talking about mainly today. And this is a social desirability measure that we used. These are the questions. Do you always help people who need help? Do you ever say anything that makes someone else feel bad? Sometimes do you do things you've been told not to do? Do you sometimes feel angry when you don't get your way? Do you sometimes feel like making fun of other people? Do you always do the right things? And you answer these yes or no, no in between. So the idea of these questions is no one is that good. You know, if you're answering these questions in the desirable way, especially if you're answering a lot of them in the desirable way, you're probably being somewhat disingenuous, and you're probably trying to portray yourself in a somewhat more positive light than is your true self. So that's our measure. And there are two worries in what I'm going to look at in our study are our overall responses biased by social desirability. So when we get our results, are we getting a somewhat rosier picture overall about stigma than is really true? And then the second worry is our patterns of results biased by social desirability. And so there's a fair bit of research saying that people of higher socioeconomic status express more tolerant, more positive attitudes towards nonconforming groups, towards people with mental illness, express greater racial egalitarianism, and things like this. But there's also evidence that at least sometimes this might be because higher SES people know and produce the right answers, or the more socially desirable or acceptable answers. I personally am always worried about high-status people coming off better than they deserve. It's kind of a lifelong worry of mine. And so we have the data to be able to explore this question in this study, and that's what I wanted to, that's my primary motivation for looking at this. It's always good to have a personal agenda to get your juices going. So today's questions are responses to socially sensitive questions in our study associated with social desirability bias and our patterns of response by SES, and we'll also look at race, ethnicity, and gender influenced by social desirability bias. And so to look at this, what outcome measures seem most subject to bias? It seemed less likely that someone's knowledge about mental illness or beliefs about the causes of mental illness, you would be thinking, oh, there's a right answer that I should be giving, that's, you know, what I should think. And so we thought negative attitudes, social distance, and self-reported avoidance of people with mental illness would be good targets to look at. And so I'm going to briefly show you these. Are those big enough that you can read them yourself? So I'll just mention a few of those. I would be comfortable meeting a person with a mental illness. I would be frightened if a person with mental illness approached me. Students with a mental illness should not be allowed in regular classes, and you can kind of see them, but they're basically, you know, negative attitudes about mental illness. And then social distance has been discussed before. Would it be okay with you to have someone with a mental illness as a neighbor, sit next to you in class, and so on. And then avoided a person with mental illness. So this is not an attitude type question, but a self-reported behavior. Did you do these things? I avoided a person who seemed too nervous, seemed depressed, said odd things because of a mental health problem, and then I felt uncomfortable being around a kid in my class that had a mental health problem, and I just don't know what to say. So that's the third measure. Now, the first thing we'll look at is to return to my original concern about higher SES people appear to have more positive attitudes about mental illness, but really it's only because they are given the socially correct answers. So that's where we're going to start at in terms of the results. First, I need to show you how I'm measuring the child's SES. And so we wanted a measure of the home environment, you know, the social class, the SES environment that the kid is growing up in, and we chose educational caretakers' educational attainment to measure that. So this is the measure of SES, is their caregivers' educational attainment. And you can see the distribution there. And it turns out I compared this to the 2010 census, and the percent with at least some college education is almost the same as the census, actually a little bit higher. So that's, you know, not off base in terms of national numbers. So here are these results, and the first two columns are multiple regressions, and those are standardized regression coefficients. And then the last column, avoided someone with mental illness, that distribution of that was pretty skewed, so our statistician dichotomized that, and that's a logistic regression, and that's a logistic a coefficient from the logistic regression in the last column. So, and we have caretakers' education, and then we have Hispanic, Black, and other race, ethnicity, and like Melissa's findings, the referent category is white, so these coefficients are all in relation to the white group. So, well, the first thing we see here is that there is no association of caretakers' association to the outcomes, which is the first piece that I was expecting to find. But on the other hand, we find a pattern with race and ethnicity is this kind of parallel to the SES finding. If you think of whites as a substitute for high SES, we find that, you know, whites have more positive attitudes and less social distance than the other racial and ethnic groups. And then we also find that girls were less likely to avoid mentally ill people. Now, if you're looking at this and you're thinking about that measure I showed you, you might think, well, caretakers' education just isn't a good enough measure of SES. There are different kinds of caretakers. The vast majority of them are biological parents, but they're not. Some of them might not have been in the home the whole time. It's just a sloppy measure of SES. So that's why we're not finding any association there. But next, we're going to look at the relationship of SES or caretaker education to social desirability bias. And here we find that caretaker's education is strongly related to the child's social desirability bias. So this is showing us that there's validity to caretaker's education as a measure of the home environment that might be influencing people's attitudes. And so education is doing something. It's just not affecting the attitudes I was expecting it to. So next, let's look at whether, so we have this association between education and bias. So let's look at whether social desirability bias is related to our stigma outcomes. Well, social desirability bias is not related to negative attitudes, and it's not related to social distance. It is related to the avoidance of a person with mental illness. So this is somewhat reassuring, I think. I mean, it means we have to worry about, when we're looking at self-reported behaviors in our study, we have to worry about those being biased. But that finding, the minus 0.117, shows us that the social desirability bias measure is working the way we expect it to. It's measuring what we want it to measure. If you score high in social desirability bias, you're less likely to say you have avoided someone with mental illness. At the same time, the other two, the first two columns, you know, show us that the social desirability bias is not working its way into the reports of the attitudes. Self-reported behaviors, yes, but when you ask people about social distance, what you would do, what you think, how you feel, it seems to not be influencing those measures. So that's, I think, overall reassuring for, you know, the validity of the results that we're getting in the study. And, oops. So finally, we'll look at whether controlling for social desirability bias influences the original patterns too, that I showed you, the associations of sociodemographics to our attitudes. And, you know, some of you have already been deducing this if you're putting together the findings I've been showing you in the different slides. But here you see, there are pairs of columns. First column is without social desirability bias, and then the second column adds social desirability bias, and we have those pairs for each of the outcome measures. And so for negative attitudes and social distance, inclusion of social desirability bias has virtually no influence on the patterns of results. For avoided mentally ill person, it has a little bit of influence there. It moves the coefficients around somewhat, but it really does not change the overall conclusions that you're going to draw about the relationship between education, race, ethnicity, and gender on avoidance of mentally ill people. So, okay, good, I'm almost done. So we didn't find what I thought we might find, which is that higher SES people have more tolerant attitudes and more social desirability bias, and that would account for their more tolerant attitudes. Didn't find that. But what we did find was that whites express more positive attitudes and less social distance towards mentally ill people, independent of caretakers' education. Girls were less likely to report avoiding someone with a mental illness. And social desirability, at least for the measures that we looked at, appears to bias self-reported behaviors, but not self-reported attitudes. And then finally, next steps. Here we used one approach to assessing and controlling social desirability bias. And then another wave of data collection, I think Bruce or Chris mentioned, we're going to have a measure of implicit attitudes in the implicit association test. And that'll give us another chance to check the validity of the self-report data. So if the patterns for implicit attitudes are similar to those for the self-reported attitudes that I've reported on today, then we would conclude, I think, that there's something about the socialization or the social environments of the white youth that's not the educational level, something else, that has led to more accepting and positive attitudes about mental illness, and suggests that Hispanic, Black, and other minority racial and ethnic groups might have a greater need for anti-stigma intervention. Thank you.
Yeah, ideally, I strongly believe in calling each illness its own illness. I don't believe in lumping mental illnesses any more than I believe in lumping asthma and diabetes as physical illnesses, because I think they're all different. However, I'm also not sure that semantics changes things. There are, like, cancer was stigmatized, but they didn't change the name. And I've gotten very irritated at times with this, some of the national effort to change the lumping of names. I'd really like for people to only discuss this, the diseases. But I remember when we went, and at that point it was mental illness. Then they changed to mental health. And I remember sitting in a session with a very high-level government person saying, we have got to eradicate mental health. And when you stop and think about that, no, we don't. The phrase du jour now is behavioral health. And personally, as a parent who has experienced the stigma, to me, behavior is a symptom. And just make your child behave is the next step of that. So I'm not a fan of that either. I do agree with you, though, that the best way to do it is individually. But when we're trying to address diseases of the brain like this, we have to somehow define them. And so at this point, we're still calling them mental illness, mental health issues, behavioral health issues. But I do know where you're coming from.